The headlines: Iran unveils its latest achievements in nuclear technology, including radiopharmaceuticals, plasma laser, and power generation programs. A Palestinian is killed and over a dozen injured in an armed confrontation with Israeli forces who raided the Jenin refugee camp. And Pakistan's parliament is gearing up for a no-confidence vote in a motion expected to decide the fate of Prime Minister Imran Khan. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisoum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran marks its National Nuclear Technology Day. The capital, Tehran, has hosted a ceremony introducing the latest achievements in nuclear technology. Top officials, including President Ebrahim Raisi and head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, were in attendance. Raisi hailed extensive research works by Iranian scientists using peaceful nuclear energy. He pledged that his government would continue to support the process. Raisi then inspected the newly unveiled 9 achievements the country has made in health and agricultural sectors using nuclear technology over the past year. Those achievements include radiopharmaceuticals, plasma, laser control systems, and power generation programs. The Iranian president emphasized his country's right to peaceful nuclear energy. He also described as irreversible Iran's technological know-how in the nuclear field. Raisi said reliance on the youth and scientists is a model that always works and should be addressed in other areas as well. Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian and wounded over a dozen in a shootout at the Jenin refugee camp north of the occupied West Bank. Israeli troops raided the camp and besieged the home of a young Palestinian man who was behind a shooting in Tel Aviv on Thursday night. A firefight broke out between Israeli forces and Palestinians at the Jenin refugee camp. There is no word yet on possible casualties on the Israeli side. At least 3 Israelis were killed and 8 more wounded in several shootings in Tel Aviv. Israeli regime forces later killed a Palestinian shooter. Resistance groups hailed the operation, saying it was a legitimate response to Israeli crimes. For more on that, we're joined by Marwa Osman, journalist and a host. Thank you very much, Marwa, for joining us. Now, there appears to be a flare-up in confrontations and armed struggle against Israeli forces. Do you believe that what we're witnessing could be the early stages of a third Palestinian intifada or uprising?
Well, I think it is going to be similar to what we saw last May 2021 with the sort of Al-Quds operation. And in support of Al-Quds and the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. But this time, if Israelis continue with this sort of aggression, we are going to see a sort of Al-Quds 2.0, because what Israelis now in the camp of Jenin is beyond human. It's basically trying to make the Palestinians kneel, trying to suppress them even further by not allowing them to voice their discontent with everything that's happening in their lives, and especially after the latest consecutive resistance operations that happened, that took place, and the latest was in what is known as Tel Aviv in Jaffa by the here Ra'ad Hazem, and forces were trying to storm Jenin as we speak now. Father of Hazem, but according to the latest news coming out of Jenin, but clashes continue between the resistance fighters and the Zionist occupation forces. So what we are looking at right now is a basic ignition to an upcoming wave, a shock wave that the Israeli regime will be feeling on all of its occupied territories, not only in Tel Aviv. This might spread to other occupied territories, 1948 occupied, and this would most definitely be Israel's worst nightmare.
So an Israeli military chief, Aviv Kochavi, has admitted that the Palestinians slipping into Israel was a security failure for the army. He's even said that Israelis are now scared of walking down the street. Such open acknowledgments of failure are not something we get to hear every day. What's your assessment?
Well, it took some time to understand that a Palestinian is a Palestinian civilian, whether he's armed to the teeth or he's unarmed, and an Israeli is a soldier, whether he is living his life on the beach or whether he is armed. They are all soldiers, they are all occupying forces, and it is a legitimate right for the Palestinians to fight for their existence, for their right to exist on their own land and to defend the liberty and the freedom of their people. So it took them a lot of time to understand that, and I think right now what they are going through is just a simple example of what might happen if everyone worked homogeneously at the same time in all of occupied Palestine, in all of the occupied territories. Add to that, if Gaza gets on board, it would be a total chaos inside of the occupied territories for the Zionist occupation forces. And I think that the mere fact that the Zionists are colonial settlers, they can never be safe from the retaliatory attacks of the Palestinian natives. It's basic history. But the Israelis were living in a lie, and the biggest lie, therefore, was the normalization that happened in the past couple of years, which ended in a basic opening of arms by certain Persian Gulf Arab states to the Israeli entity, thinking that this will just drag the Palestinians into a coercive, peaceful solution when their lives are at stake here. But that did not happen, and it was not a shock. But I think if the Israelis are in shock, they basically don't know what's happening underneath their feet.
Thank you very much. And now that was our guest from Beirut, Marwa Osman, journalist. Now, moving on. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance groups defend the recent retaliatory operation in Tel Aviv, slamming the regional countries that condemned the incident. A spokesman for Hamas resistance movement deplored Turkey and Bahrain for their critical stance. Hazem Ghassem said Palestinians are acting in self-defense, which is backed by international law. The Islamic Jihad movement separately reacted to the condemnations by Turkey, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates. The movement said Palestinians pay no attention to such remarks. Both groups also slammed the Palestinian Authority for denouncing the attack. They said the comments by its officials not only serve the Israeli regime propaganda against Palestinians.
After an hours-long manhunt throughout Tel Aviv, Israeli forces clashed with Raad Hazem and killed him in Yaffa. 28-year-old Raad Hazem from Jenin refugee camp in the north of the occupied West Bank was the Palestinian man who opened fire in Dezengov shopping street in central Tel Aviv Thursday night, killing two Israelis and wounding nine others. The Palestinian resistance groups praised the operation, describing it as heroic. Hamas resistance groups said it proves resistance is continuing and escalating, while the Islamic Jihad said the operation confirmed how fragile the Israeli regime is.
The assassination of any Palestinian, Tel Aviv's crimes, and aggression on Al-Aqsa Mosque is responded by more heroic operations. So it's a natural and legitimate response. Israel must expect that any future steps or crimes would definitely drag such reactions.
Following the operation, more than 1,000 police officers joined a manhunt, while the Israeli settlers were ordered to get off the streets and remain at home. Experts say the operation that was the latest string of deadly operations across the occupied territories and the fourth in 2.5 weeks had confused the Israeli regime and proved its weakness.
This operation in particular has really shocked the Israeli society, and the Israeli regime is broken on all levels, even the security level, because they deal with the Palestinian as a security problem and not people having political and historic rights. This operation is telling them that Palestinians exist as real owners and they have a right in these lands.
Meanwhile, Israeli military has declared its forces will be on high alert in Al-Quds for the first Friday prayers of the holy month of Ramadan. The Israeli police bolstered their forces in Al-Quds, and more troops have stationed on the numerous checkpoints in the occupied West Bank, imposing more strict measures against the Palestinians. Palestinians say the Israeli military thought its crackdown and aggression following the March 22nd operation that claimed four Israeli lives led to a state of calm in the occupied territories. However, Raad Hazem's Thursday attack that killed two more Israelis reminded the regime that the entire Palestinian lands are occupied and that the resistance continues. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Security has beefed up around Pakistan's parliament as it convenes to vote on whether Prime Minister Imran Khan should stay in office. The country's top court has ordered a no-confidence vote that could lead Khan's dismissal. The Prime Minister accepted the verdict but insisted that he was a victim of a regime change conspiracy involving the U.S. Pakistan embroiled into a political crisis last week after a key ally of the ruling party switched sides, prompting the opposition to issue a no-trust motion. However, Khan blocked the process and dissolved parliament. After days of hearings, the Supreme Court late on Thursday announced Khan's move unlawful. If he loses the no-confidence vote, the opposition will choose a new prime minister, and Shahbaz Sharif, the younger brother of three-time former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, is the potential candidate to rule the South Asian country until the next polls. And Ukraine is calling for harsher sanctions against Russia after a missile attack hit a train station in the eastern city of Kramatorsk. The attack left 52 people dead. President Volodymyr Zelensky says the strike was a deliberate attack on civilians and a war crime. He says Kiev expects a firm global response and called for an energy embargo on Russia. Zelensky also called for all Russian banks to be cut off from the global system and demanded more weapons. He says any delay in providing arms for Ukraine would mean politicians want out Moscow more than Kiev. The Kremlin, at the same time, has urged the West to stop supplying weapons to Kiev and blamed the Ukrainian military for the Kramatorsk attack.
Today, on April 8th, the Ukrainian military struck the railway station of Kramatorsk with a Tochka-U missile. Tochka-U missiles, which remains were found near the railway station, are used only by the Ukrainian military.
Russia's defense ministry also says the missiles were launched from a Donbass territory controlled by Ukrainian forces. The conflict is now in its 45th day. According to UN's Human Rights Office, over 1,600 civilians have been killed in Ukraine. More than 2,200 others have been injured, while another 11,000 have left their homes. The European Union is adding more than 200 individuals to its blacklist of sanctions against Russia over its military operation in Ukraine. The list includes two daughters of the Russian president, as well as top businessmen, politicians, and military staff close to the Kremlin. The sanctions also target officials from Luhansk and Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. The restrictions include asset seizures and travel bans in the EU. The bloc has sanctioned around 700 people linked to Russia and slapped tough economic sanctions on the country since it moved on Ukraine. In response, Moscow has announced retaliatory measures against European countries. Footage has been released apparently showing Ukrainian soldiers executing a Russian prisoner of war outside a village west of the capital, Kiev. In the video, at least three men can be seen lying dead next to a fourth man who is breathing heavily with a jacket covering his head. Then a voice is heard saying that he is still breathing. Afterwards, a soldier shoots the man twice in the head. The man continues to move. The soldier shoots again and stops. The living soldiers in the video are wearing the Ukrainian colors blue and yellow on their arms. The men on the floor are wearing white armbands, which are used by Russian troops. The video was first shared on a Telegram, and some Western media outlets have verified it. The Ukrainian government has pledged an investigation. And China has warned of, quote, serious consequences of Russia's suspension from the UN Human Rights Council. It says the move will simply fan the flames of war in Ukraine.
The drafting process of the relevant resolution was not open or transparent, nor did it follow the practice of going through consultations of all member states and heeding views extensively. This way of doing things will only aggravate the division among member states, intensify contradictions among the parties concerned, and add fuel to the fire, which is not conducive to de-escalating the conflict, still less pushing for peace negotiations. To handle the issue of membership of the Human Rights Council this way will set a new dangerous precedent, further intensifying confrontation and induce a still bigger impact on the UN governance system with serious consequences.
Zhao Lijian also stated that China is against politicizing human rights to pressure other countries. The Chinese official cautioned against what he called a selective approach towards the issue of human rights. This after the UN General Assembly voted to suspend Russia from the Human Rights Council. China was among the 24 countries against the U.S.-initiated motion. In the meantime, Moscow has labeled the vote illegal and politically driven. Russia stands accused of human rights violations and abuses in Ukraine, but the Kremlin denies the accusations. And just a day ahead of France's presidential polls, a race for the top job is reaching its climax, with the two main rivals, incumbent Emmanuel Macron and far-right leader Marine Le Pen, making last-minute appeals to win more votes. Still, there are indications that a large segment of the French public might be reluctant to cast their ballots because they're unhappy with the presidential campaign and the status quo in general. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The birth and development of the American police can be traced to a multitude of historical, legal, and political economic conditions. The institution of slavery and the control of minorities, however, were two of the more formidable historic features of American society shaping early policing. Slave patrols and night watches, which later became modern police departments, were both designed to control the behaviors of minorities. Slave patrols help to maintain the economic order and to assist the wealthy landowners in recovering and punishing slaves who essentially were considered property. Though many years have passed from the abolishment of slavery, police brutality is the enduring legacy of slavery in the U.S. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Stay with us as this documentary talks to activists, specialists, and family members of police brutality victims to depict the true picture of systematic injustice and racism in the heart of American society. Don't go away. Here's the first part.
Eric Garner went unconscious.
There were cops used a chokehold that allegedly led to Eric Garner's death.
And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever.
Medical examiner said Eric Garner.
Police say they arrested
him after
police
were so. I couldn't stop wondering why. I was screaming at the TV.
His death now being called a homicide.
In a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to indict an NYPD officer in the death of a man on Staten Island. They said that they are going to be out here every night marching until they get an indictment in the death of Eric Garner. There is just as much anger out here tonight, just as much passion.
You see these police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard. The protesters are basically right in their faces.
Protesters in Minneapolis have attempted to shut down the city's airport this afternoon. The group representing the Black Lives Matter movement blocked two roads outside a terminal before state police ordered the group to disperse. Back to the situation in downtown Los Angeles, looks like protesters have moved now onto the 101 freeway in downtown. Earlier in the day, organizers of the group promised that a demonstration involving hundreds of protesters would shut down the Mall of America.
You know, I don't remember the kind of life before of what's going on. Like, you know, all of my activities have to do with basically what we call the revolution. You kind of just dive in it head first. It's like, so you can't stop. And, you know, I feel like if I stop this time, I can no longer complain about anyone that's murdered unarmed after, you know, Akai Gurley and Eric Garner and Mike Brown. So I have to keep going with this. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was in the movement for 13 years before he was assassinated. So it's not something that's going to be overnight. The significance to me of Black Lives Matter is that it's something that's nationwide. It's not just a New York problem, it's a New Jersey problem, it's across the United States. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is basically calling attention that, hey, you know, you say that all lives matter, and yes, all lives matter, but Black lives aren't mattering right now. So that's what we're trying to let you guys know is, hey, you know, hi, Black Lives Matter. You know, we're being kind of hunted, and it's a little bit of a pattern. At first, you know, people could say maybe it was a coincidence, but now it's just a pattern. And it's almost like every year there's some, you know, publicly broadcasted, you know, murder of an unarmed African-American or brown person.
Well, I moved to New York in November for work. I'm an attorney. I work in banking and financial compliance, but I've always been really active outside of work in, like, activists and social justice missions. And I don't think people want to confront the issue that there's an issue with our system, that our police, not all of them, but there are some within those ranks, are brutalizing and terrorizing American citizens. And so I believe in our Constitution. I do believe in our criminal justice system. I think it, you know, it has the potential to be a great system, but the corruption within it and the bias within it makes it a very dangerous system for black and brown people.
Our justice system is not corrupt. It's just very decentralized in comparison to other democratic countries. And when it's decentralized, it's based on a variety of standards for people who are part of the system. And some of the standards are not as high as we would like them to see. And then people paint with a very broad brush, extrapolating from one jurisdiction to another. Definitely we have race issues in our society, not just in the United States, in many other countries. Police officers are recruited from the society and from the community. So there's no doubt in my mind that some of the officers have various biases.
On February 26, 2012, in Sanford, Florida, Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old high school student coming home from a nearby convenience store, was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch captain. Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. When police arrived at the scene, Zimmerman admitted that he shot Martin, but he claimed he had acted in self-defense. No charges were initially brought against Zimmerman. It was not until the shooting garnered national attention that Zimmerman was charged in connection with Martin's death. In July 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of all charges. Upon the not guilty verdict, there were protests nationwide in more than 100 cities. President Obama said that he identified with the boy. Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Why was it that Trayvon tended to fizzle out? Well, one reason was because he got all of that rage that was finally manifest, but it was geared toward what? Laws, stand your ground. It wasn't geared toward the powers that be. It wasn't geared toward the federal government. It wasn't geared toward the White House. It was geared toward state laws. Well, why is that so? Well, that's exactly what the powers that be wanted it to be. You see, the president's office, what did he do? He sent his own extension, who was Sharpton. And Sharpton gives a great speech, and it's all about state laws rather than police going to jail. Everybody knows that you're not going to change arbitrary police power until policemen start going to jail. Why is it that in the last 7 years you haven't had one policeman go to jail? It's the same reason why you haven't had one Wall Street executive go to jail. Because the government doesn't want them to go to jail. The government don't want to put power in that direction to go to jail. You can rest be assured, if you had a massive network of poor people engaged in gangster activity like Wall Street did with market manipulation and insider trading, those folk gonna get caught and go to jail. You can rest be assured that the police were killing well-to-do white folk. Some policemen was going to jail. It's a priority. It's not a priority of the U.S. government to send policemen to jail. Not until it starts affecting them in the way it already affects many of us. And you see, some of us believe that the life of a poor black person, a poor brown person, has exactly the same value as that of a well-to-do white or well-to-do black or anybody else of the upper class.
We did have officers jailed for excessive force, especially in we had a case, an infamous case in Charleston in South Carolina, when the officer shot an individual in his back, and he was actually, he's right now in prison. The judicial system is not designed to avoid prosecution of police officers, but because the standard is a standard of discretion of the individual police officer, and the standard is based on, again, individual perceptions of the situations, it appears sometimes that there is injustice because we look at this behavior in hindsight, and for us it appears as excessive, but for the officer at the given moment on the street it wasn't excessive, and the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street, where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police have shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted. The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. The only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. The footage at the convenience store is not very, you know, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality, where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed, assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African American women have been playing a central role.
Cigarettes,
let's arrest them. Let's have them go before a jury of his peers,
yeah.
And let's use the system the way it's supposed to be used. Cops are not supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story, yeah. Really.
Like, say hypothetically, one or two of these shootings are justified. They don't even give us that opportunity to think, you know, critically about it, because regardless of what happens with the situation, they're not held accountable, which is the part that bothers me the most. It's like, regardless of what's happening, it's a little boy, unarmed, kid sleeping, a grown man, you know, selling cigarettes, no matter what the police does to them, they're not being held accountable for it.
And there's no data. That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, I mean, because I like Esther's, her list of demands, they kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement. But there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, you know, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on, like, the momentum that we have here.
Yeah.
And definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think, like, our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people on a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So Thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica night after night. I mean, we do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her. Yeah.
And she needs that consistency.
Absolutely.
On July 17, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Gardner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Gardner in a chokehold. Gardner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Gardner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Gardner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Gardner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
On July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's all, my mom is, you know, all hysterical, crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said, "Dad, just stop breathing." So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. You know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part of where it happened, and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape, and we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet, and would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop. Like, I couldn't stop wondering why, you know. I was screaming at the TV. Because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes. And it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we seen on the TV, on the computer to our grandparents or to my mother, because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just... You know, my whole body, it was just, like, shaky. It was, I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything. And people noticed me. I never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn. But my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter. And when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions of the story, and it was just like, wow. I still can't believe this happened. Yeah.
The Eric Garner case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is patrol guide or operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures has been changed since Eric Garner case.
A recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Tonight, it was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on this shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnback, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother, being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility, but again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have fear. They have more fear probably than an average person because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
You know, Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the Black lives that are the last ones that have value.
Even within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about color blindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
There is just as much anger out here.
There's police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.
This is
For a Better Life.
For a Better Life.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
A'udhu billahi min shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Some people keep wondering as to why Allah prescribed fasting on His servants. What could be the purpose of fasting, and what are the goals that we can achieve after fasting a whole month? What are the benefits that we can expect to get after a month of fasting? So these are some important questions that we will try to address in this episode. Brothers and sisters, there are various aspects associated with fasting. They also possess numerous physical and spiritual benefits. These tend to have a great impact on man. The most important of them is the ethical aspect and the educative philosophy. The fasting of Ramadan is going to change our character, our akhlaq, and it's going to have an educative impact. It's going to have, you know, a lasting and an enduring impact on our conscience, on our spirituality, on our mentality towards other people, towards our neighbors, towards the poor and the needy. Now, to further explain the benefits of fasting, I would like to say that fasting makes man's soul kind, strengthens his determination, and moderates his instincts. In other words, fasting creates balance between his physical and spiritual dimensions. It balances his physical instincts. When an individual fasts, despite his hunger and thirst, he must stay away from food, water, and sexual pleasures and prove practically that he is not an animal within a stable, but an entity that can rein in, that can control his wild soul, his wild nafs, and overcome his lust and carnal desires. So, fasting is not only about, you know, abstaining from food and drink, but obviously abstaining from food and drink and engaging in sexual activities are some of the things that every individual must do in the month of Ramadan. Every able-bodied and every duty-bound person must do. But obviously abstaining from these things will ultimately have its impacts on the human soul, and it will strengthen his determination. It will, balance his instincts, and at the end of the day, he will be able to overcome his lust and carnal desires, and he will be in a position to control his lower self, which is his nafsi ammara. In fact, the most important philosophy of fasting is this very spiritual effect. Man, who has a variety of food and drinks at his disposal and who can reach out for them the moment he experiences thirst or hunger, is like the trees that grow near the rivers, seeking support of the walls of the gardens, you know. These fondled and pampered trees possess less resistance and are short-lived, you know. The more water you give to trees, the more you tend to them, the more delicate they are, the more susceptible, the more vulnerable they are. But if water does not reach trees for a few days, they immediately dry up and wither away. But on the contrary, of course, the trees which grow between the rocks on the mountains or in the deserts are strong, they are durable, they are highly resistant. And of course, you cannot compare the trees that grow on desert with trees that grow on the sides of the rivers. They are poles apart. They are totally different. The first one is not resistant. It breaks very easily. And it dries up when water does not reach them. But the second type of trees are trees that are highly resistant. They are durable. They are strong. And they do not break. Even if there is a strong, for example, storm, if there is a strong wind, it's not going to affect them. You know, the same is the case with fasting. This is the impact of fasting. If you fast in the month of Ramadan, you are going to be resistant. You are going to have a firm determination. You are going to have a firm resolve. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Fasting helps, it strengthens, it solidifies man's soul. It grants the soul, for example, in exchange for the temporary restrictions, a strong determination. It grants the soul steadfastness, and it helps the soul to achieve the ability to face up the hardships and severe occurrences. There are difficult times, and these difficult times can easily be tolerated by a fasting person because he has suffered hunger, he has suffered thirst, and he has observed fast. Even though staying hungry, fasting, not eating is not the purpose of fasting. The concept of fasting is to purify yourself. لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ, just as the verse, the Quranic verse 183 of Surah Al-Baqarah says, you know. So it controls the unruly instincts. Fasting will enable the individual to rein in the instincts, to control them, and it makes man's heart pure and luminous. Fasting helps man to detach himself from the world of animals. It elevates him into the realm of angels, supreme individuals, the lofty individuals. You know, لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ, the Quranic verse which says, so that you may guard against evil. This is the concept. And this is the goal of fasting, of course. So, which the verse 130 of Surah Al-Baqarah says. And as I said, the verse makes a clear allusion to the philosophy behind fasting. And of course, there are many, many ahadith, many traditions that have been transmitted on the authority of different narrators. One of the well-known traditions from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, is the tradition which says, As-sawmu junnatun minan nar. The fast is a shield. The fast is a shield against the fire. It makes a clear reference to the very concept of taqwa, which is the goal of fasting. We read in the tradition that some companions asked the noble prophet, peace be upon him, what should we do to keep the shaitan away from us? The prophet, peace be upon him, and his family replied, fasting blackens the face of shaitan. Charity in the way of Allah breaks his back. Befriending someone for the sake of Allah and persevering in performing good deeds cuts his roots, and seeking forgiveness severs the vein of his heart. The Prophet has been reported to have said while welcoming the month of Ramadan, Du'itum ila dhiyafatillah, you have been invited to a divine banquet. So what does it mean, a divine banquet? Obviously, divine banquet means that this month of Ramadan is the month of Rahmah, this is the month of forgiveness, this is the month of mercy. And of course, those who fast and those who recite the Holy Quran, those who do good deeds, their reward will be multiplied. The month of Ramadan is the month of God. And of course, in this month, we are all invited. And we will achieve the rewards for our good deeds, whatever. Even a small good indeed is multiplied. And for example, if we recite one verse of the Holy Quran, it is as though we have recited the entire Quran in other months. So that's all for this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade. hit of palm, every closed hand in us. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash in us. Every thought I had and every word I share in us.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.